Hey, it's JD here, and welcome to Discovering Downey. We're back again with a Friday bonus episode, and this week we've got a barn burner for you. We've got Alan Cross joining us to talk about Gord. We've also got two-thirds of our regular co-hosts. We've got Justin in the house, and we've got Craig here joining us from Vancouver. How are you two doing, fellas?
It's going well, yeah. Summer's finally here, sort of.
Excellent. Excellent. Doing great. I'm on vacation in Ohio right now between Canada Day and Independence Day.
So. Yeah. All right. Well, as I mentioned, we've got a great episode today. And if there was ever such a thing as a fountain of all musical knowledge, then surely our guest today has quenched his insatiable thirst from said fountain at one point or another. Alan, have you drunk from the fountain of all musical knowledge at some point in your life?
I don't know. I mean, I get to do this every single day of my life, so it's not that much of a mystery. It's something I just, anybody could do it if they did it as often as I did.
That's spectacular. Well, you do a great job, and we love you for it. I've listened since I moved to Toronto, and I mean, this is dating both of us, but I moved here for university in 94, and I listened to you when you were on afternoons on CFNY, and then, of course, when the Ongoing History of New Music started, I was, you know, pretty much there every Sunday night at 7, and it was a wonderful thing, so thank you very much for that.
Oh, you're very welcome.
So today we're here to talk about Gord Downey. We've spent 10 episodes at this point, when you're listening to this, going through each of his albums in his discography and experiencing them for the first time, which has been really an eye-opening treat. It's been really wonderful to just experience these records. My first question to you, Alan Cross, is... what is your Tragically Hip origin story?
It would have been working at CFNY back in 88. Wow. And the first Tragically Hip EP arrived. And at that point, they were still very much an independent band, but you could tell that there was something interesting about them. They were perhaps a little more gritty, a little more bluesy than a lot of the alternative music that was coming in at that point. Now, alternative was a strange sort of way to describe them, but they were a new unsigned band, and that made them interesting. So we played a number of songs from that first EP, and then when Up to Here came out a few years later, We were all over it, simply because that was such a great record, and for a time, they kind of became the CFNY house band, in the sense that we would get them to play various events, like the Canada Day event up in Molson Park and Barrie. I remember there was one year, and I think it might have been 89, where they played our station Christmas party, and we had a station band open for them.
Oh, wow.
And just from there on in, you know, whatever the hip did, we followed.
Yeah, I can remember when Fully came out, and especially Day for Night, the Sunday night episodes breaking down the songs one by one, those were just fantastic. Mm. What about your interaction with the enigmatic Mr. Downey? Was that something that you noticed early on, like his je ne sais quoi?
Now, when the hip first started, they were very much a collaborative thing. Everybody, all five guys, would bring in song ideas, and they would riff on songs together and come up with material. That's the way it worked through to probably the end of the Up to Here album cycle. After that, Gord became more of the lyrical driver. He would be the guy that came up with the ideas for songs, the song titles, the lyrics, and then the band would work around them. And as we went from Trouble at the Hen House forward, everything else became, you know, that was the order of that was the order of business. Gord would come in with lyrics, and everybody else would sort of follow along to what Gord was doing. Now, Gord always was, in my experience, an artiste. And when I say artiste, I'm talking about someone who lives to create art, whatever that art might be. And they live that lifestyle. They live in that bubble in their head. And that's really, you know, that makes up so much of their personality, so much of their life. It wasn't like he was, you know, like a John Frusciante and off in the clouds all the time. But you could tell that this man was always reading, he was always thinking, and he was always trying to come up with new ways of expressing what he had learned, what he had thought about, the people he met, and the places that he visited.
What we've noticed over the course of this project is how many times we've said, wow, that sounds like nothing we've heard Gord do before. So talking about his solo work. Mm-hmm. And what do you think made Gord such a unique frontman and solo artist?
As a frontman, there's two separate things here. As a frontman, if you remember seeing the Tragically Hip, the man would go into a trance. He was an unstoppable force on stage in front of an audience, and he went to those places that a frontman goes whenever they are on stage and things seem to be rocking. He would. Of course, there's the long jams where he would do the stream of consciousness stuff. You know, the Killer Whale Tank thing would be an example. So many other songs, you know, came lyrically and musically from those jams where Gord would just go off and be Gord. Later on, everybody would come together and say, hey, you remember what we did? And, you know, this is a band that recorded everything. They recorded all their live gigs. And they'll go, hey, you know, we remember that show back in Belleville or in Winnipeg where, you know, we did this? I think there's something there. So they would go back and listen to that tape and pull out some ideas, and those would become future songs. Now, Gord as a person offstage was, in my experience, a very, very humble, very quiet sort of guy. I'll give you an example. So I think this was the Coke Machine Glow album, I think. It was one of those records. And he came into the building, and he was early, which never happens. Anyway, I was busy working on I was doing another interview, and I stopped for a second. I went, Gord, I hate to do this, but, you know, I'm running late and we need this. I got to finish this interview before you and I can talk. He says, no problem. I'll just go to Starbucks and get a coffee. Can I get you anything? Yeah, sure. I'll take a latte. You want a grande? Yeah. And he left. And then it just occurred to me that I just sent the front man for the Tragically Hip to get me a coffee at Starbucks. And he came back. He gave it to me. And it was, this is what you want? Yep. Okay. And then we sat down. We had a lovely interview where we talked about the album and, you know, Water Keepers and some of the other activist things that he was involved in. And again, I talked to Gord Sinclair the other day, and we were talking about the upcoming Up to Here box set, which will be out in, I think, November. Yeah, November. And, you know, we were talking about that, you know, period of the band's life and what they were doing. And he says, you know, we're just a bunch of guys who like to play music. We're from a small town where we don't have any, you know, major egos. We just like what we do. We're all music nerds. And this is what we want to do. And they were, for the entire time that I've known all five of the guys, they've just been normal human beings, the kind of people that you would sit down at a bar with and have a beer. And I think that's a very important aspect to the Tragically Hip's popularity and the continuing love the country seems to have for them.
I've got, a bit of a follow-up on that, and maybe your answer kind of squashes my question. But he was known as such an intellectual and so well-read and
mm-hmm.
but also very kind and very, you know, normal, I guess. But do you ever find yourself maybe intimidated in like, what the hell am I going to talk about with Gord Downie? You know, he's read every book written.
Yeah. I mean, if for example, again, he was so very deep into a lot of Canadiana, you know, Marshall McLuhan, Al Purdy, you know, the indigenous situation in the country. The best way to talk to Gord was to get him to talk about his passions. So, you know, talk about Al Purdy, talk about the environment, talk about, you know, small town Ontario, talk about hockey. And he would do it. And you would learn something from him because he was so well versed in all these different subjects. That's one of the best ways to conduct an interview with somebody that you know knows way more about stuff than you do. Get them to tell you what they know. And at the end, you know, you'll learn something. They will have felt good because they were able to spread their gospel and their opinions and their knowledge. And then when the interview gets packaged and goes out to the general public, they will learn something about an artist that they did not know before, plus all the other stuff that that they've just spoken about.
So I've been listening to you, Alan, since the, I don't know, early 90s. Your show was on syndication in the Okanagan on the Kelowna,
mm-hmm.
The Lizard in Kelowna. And so I'd listen to the ongoing history of new music. And then down when I moved to Vancouver on CFOX and I think mm-hmm. Rock 101 for a time. So you're like an encyclopedia of rock knowledge. So I've got a question for you. And this isn't a trivia question. This is just something sure. I've asked a few people. So other than the Hip, can you think of another, you know, 5-piece band with, you know, 12 plus albums that lasted 30 plus years without any lineup changes?
Sloan.
Okay.
Would definitely be one. There's 4 guys in the band. We can talk about Rush, but that's only 3 guys.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah. U2 until recently, I guess, was one I thought of this morning, but.
So are we talking about international bands?
Well, just successful bands.
Radiohead. Radiohead's been around since about 1985 more or less the same form.
They still feel new to me.
I know. You figure out that they've been around for a long time.
Yeah, we could,
up until recently, Motley Crue. You know, U2 has been together since 1978. The Larry Mullen thing with the Sphere was a temporary situation.
Right.
So once his back gets better, they'll be, you know, back together as their original 4-piece. Yeah. It's very hard to keep a band together for any length of time. A very smart person in the industry once told me that the average length of a musical career is about 7 years. It's during that time, you form a band with all the bluster and fury of youth. You learn how to play your instruments. You learn how to perform. You learn how to write songs. You grow as a band. You grow as individuals. And eventually, you start growing apart. You each have your own separate personal interests, whether it be musical or social or family or whatever. And then by the time you get to year 7, year 8, all that youthful energy is gone because you've grown up. So keeping a group together beyond 7 years is a real challenge, and you really need to have a sense of all for one, one for all to keep it going beyond that. Now, there were a number of times when the Tragically Hip looked like they were done. I remember, who was it? It was one of the guys, maybe it was Paul. This would be sometime in the early 2000s when the Hip wasn't really doing all that much. You know, Gord was off doing his solo albums. The other guys weren't really doing much. There was a sense that the Hip had kind of run out of steam with some of the fans. And he described the band as a vintage convertible that's in the garage that you bring out for special occasions. And that was a bit, that was rather kind of sad because, you know, nobody wanted to see the hip go away and nobody wanted to think of the hip as an old convertible. But a few years after that, the band was more or less reactivated. And they continued to be a working band and a recording band until Gord died.
Thank you for coming. You ready for summer?
In preparing to talk to you, I listened to your Gord episode, and there was a small snippet on the Gord episode from last November that it's you conducting a great conversation with him where you call him a poet off the top, and then the intention of the conversation is to discuss the Grand Bounce song by song. So you almost shoot yourself in the foot at the beginning by saying, you know, he's not going to, a poet isn't, doesn't want to discuss their words. And then it's like, you've got this poet laureate sitting in front of you that is there to discuss his words.
Yeah. But
and it's really humorous. The clip that you put in the episode, but yeah, the whole thing, like, wow, how was that?
He never really wanted to explain exactly what he was trying to say. And if you went to any of the other guys, they would say exactly the same thing. What's Gord trying to say? I don't know. What does it mean to you? So, okay, At some point, you know, everyone, that's maddening at some point, because if you run across some really obtuse lyrics, some really, you know, artsy lyrics, and you're confused, you know, what are you trying to say, Gord? What do you want me to know? What do you want me to take away from this? And when he won't explain it, it's like, well, it's almost like a cop out. And that's a terrible way to phrase it, but you know, again, this is a guy that came up with a lot of his lyrical ideas through these stream of consciousness rants while on stage with the rest of the group. And it's yeah, so poetry at its best is something that means something in the eye of the beholder, the eye of the listener. And really it's up to each one of us to figure out exactly what something means to us.
Did you ever happen to get any solid answers on anything out of him about it? I mean, or
not really, you know, you probe a little bit and then you know, he would say, well, what does it mean to you? Okay. Well, I guess that's end of conversation.
Yeah. I mean, I always loved the Bob Cage, and you know, he came up with that because he couldn't rhyme with anything else. He's like, you know, hate to burst your bubble, but I was walking home from Baskin Robbins and I thought of this, you know. It's
yeah, not Bob Cajun was the only word I could think they rhymed with constellation, you know. Okay, it's kind of like Chris Martin and the song Yellow. The reason he was looking for a word to rhyme or to work into the lyrics, and he looked across the room and he saw the book of the Yellow Pages book. and that's why Yellow by Coldplay is called Yellow, because the Yellow Pages were sitting there. So same thing with Bob Cajun. It rhymed with constellation. And again, but at the same time, it works because, again, you could probably teach a course in Canadian history and Canadian geography and Canadian sociology just through the lyrics of Gord Downie, you know, all the places and people that he name checks. So if somebody talks about the 100th meridian, well, what does that mean? Oh, well, I'm going to go, oh, 100th meridian is sort of like the dividing point of Canada east and west, and it goes all the way down to the Great Plains, and, you know, there's some geography there and some topography there. Bob Cajun, well, what's Bob Cajun? Well, Bob Cajun is this town in northern Ontario, in north central Ontario. So, you know, who was Hugh McClellan? You know,
Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at ChumbaCasino.com. VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18+.
Again, another example, you listen to a song like 38 Years Old, and then you're led down the rabbit hole of David Milgaard. So there's a lot of stuff there that Gord didn't have to be specific. He could just drop the references. And I think he knew that if he dropped the references, fans would take it upon themselves to find out what those references meant, and then end up going down a bunch of different personal rabbit holes.
How many singers do you think you need a second source for? That's so strange.
Well, that's true. I mean, you know, Bono is certainly one. Bowie was another. You know, these are they're rare. They're polymaths of sorts. You know, extremely well read on a variety of different subjects. You know, how do you, you know, for example, write a song about Hugh McClellan? You know, here's a Canadian political thinker. He talks about the two solitudes in Canada. How do you turn that into a rock song? Yet he managed to do it. Yeah, he doesn't mention it in the song. He doesn't mention Hugh's name in the song, but but if you look at the title and then you look at the rest of the lyrics, you get the implication that there's an aspect of something courageous here. So what is it? All right, well, time to pull out the encyclopedia or look up Wikipedia.
I I kind of went off on a tangent when we did our first episode about Coke Machine Glow. There were a lot of references to World War II and Adolf Hitler that I thought I interpreted. And I think it kind of, I think I was the only one that was even close to that sort of interpretation among our group on the podcast. And, you know, some of the other guys here were thinking, oh, a chancellor, for example, you know, the head of a university or Star Wars or, you know, other things. And it's, I think that's kind of what Gord was going for is, you know, make up your own story, right?
Well, it is. A good poet will lay a foundation for your imagination, and then it's up to you to take it from there. And he did that an awful lot. I mean, even the title of the album, Coke Machine Glow, I mean, you know exactly what he's talking about. What an evocative set of words. You can just imagine one of these things sitting outside a motel somewhere at night, and it's the only light around, or in a building after hours, and all the hallway lights are out. You know, that's difficult to do as a creator. This being evocative, and Gord was excellent at it. He didn't always get it right. I mean, some of those there are some dogs on those solo albums. But that's fine. I mean, you put it out to the world and see what the world gives back.
Why, in your estimation, it's almost like a second branch to the age-old question as to, you know, why was the Tragically Hip not extremely popular or the same level of popularity south of the border as they were?
Oh, I can answer that, and that has nothing to do with the Tragically Hip's music or talent. What happens is that at a record label in the United States, you have all these A&R guys, and their job is to sniff out new talent and then sign that talent and then nurture that talent through to success. This has happened a lot with Canadian acts, especially ones that don't want to move out of Canada into the US. What happens is they get signed to an American distribution deal, and they have an A&R champion at the American label. And then something goes wrong. Maybe it's with the economy. Maybe it's with the label itself. Maybe it's with the A&R dude. And that guy gets fired. Now, when an A&R dude gets fired, all the acts that he signed become toxic automatically. Well, maybe the acts that he signed contributed to his firing. So nobody wants anything to do with them. Nobody wants to take any ownership of them. Nobody wants to take any responsibility with them for them. And that's what happens with a lot of Canadian bands south of the border. It happened with Billy Talent. It almost happened with Nickelback a couple of times. It certainly happened with Blue Rodeo. It happened with, and it happened with The Hip. Another thing that can happen is that it's just bad timing. You know, you're at the wrong place in the rock cycle. So there's no money for marketing and distribution because it's all gone to hip-hop or it's all gone to pop or whatever it is. And the band just gets lost in the shuffle. Happens all the time. And it doesn't only happen with Canadian bands. It happens with American bands who are, for whatever reason, not declared to be priorities with the label. And the A&R guy suffers as a result. And so does the band, obviously.
That's fascinating to me, and we've talked a little bit more about that on the Fully and Completely podcast a few years ago. I'm not sure if you remember that, but where I wanted to take this is, you know, sort of the next, flipping the page from that question, you've got the question of Gord's solo work not performing to the level of the Tragically Hip or anywhere close to the level of the Tragically Hip. And yet he's sort of the centerpiece of the band. He's the front man, you know, like he's got immense popularity and these songs are really good. What happened?
Yeah, they're good, but they're also pretty esoteric. They're not mainstream songs. They're maybe, you know, there's not a lot of what you would call singles on Gord's records. They are collections of album tracks. And even the record labels didn't really say, okay, well, this is going to be a single, and we're going to push this single to radio and to video channels and wherever else. There never really was that. Gord's solo material was his own personal private musings, things that he had inside him that he needed to get out, and they came out in a variety of ways. But honestly, despite their quality that some people recognize, these records weren't terribly commercial. They just weren't. And as a result, they became something for the hardcore, the faithful, and not for the public at large. Again, nothing to do with the quality of the music, but certainly, but definitely in terms of the nature of the music. Not a lot of hooks, not a lot of grinding riffs,
I agree with you for Coke Machine Glow and Battle of the Nudes, and I think maybe people took off after that.
It could
because the next two records, The Grand Bounce and the record with the Sadies, are like total straight up rock and roll records, but people just probably didn't get to them because of the esotericness, to use your word, of the previous two records.
And the records were not marketed that way.
Right.
It was like the way it sort of came out was, and this is my recollection, it's like, oh, another Gord Downie album. And that was it. And it was expected that, you know, Gord would the faithful would pick up the mission from there. And it never really happened. I mean, none of Gord's records caught fire at radio in Canada. None of them.
No.
He got feature play. He got play on the CBC. He got play on campus radio stations. But there is no such thing as a Gord Downie solo hit single.
Do you think that maybe there was an oversaturation of Gord Downie material, whether it was the hip?
Maybe. Or maybe again we were in a different position in the music cycle. You know, if we go to the later Gord albums, I mean, we were definitely into a pop phase as far as music was concerned vis-a-vis the mainstream. So it didn't really have a home. It wasn't given the appropriate push. And again, you know, those records were not on major labels. They were on indies, as far as I remember. And, you know, indies only have so much pull and only so much money and only so much influence. So, there's part of me that says that, you know, Gord could have had like a Universal Records deal. I'm sure he could have had a Universal Records deal. And then they would have blown it up. But I think what he really wanted, and this is just my theory, is that he wanted some low-key stuff that allowed him to do whatever he wanted without any sort of meddling or notes from a record label or a producer or anything. So he could just make music the way he wanted to make music outside the Tragically Hip without all the pressures and expectations due. Now, when the convertible came out of the garage, well, that was a different thing. Because, and it was a different Gord, too, when he was working with the rest of the guys. But when he was working on his own or was working with his collaborators or the Sadies or something, it was a different headspace. And that's what he wanted to capture.
I remember seeing an interview, and I think I've referenced it on our shows a couple of times, that he did on the CBCQ, where, you know, 6 or 8 years after Cook Machine Glow came out, he said to, I think it was John Gomeshi at the time, he said, I'd like to meet the guy that wrote Cook Machine Glow, because I have no idea who that was. Do you think that his evolution as an artist, as a songwriter, changed so much over time that people were like, what is this? Like, I don't even understand it.
Well, listen, if we go back to the Hip, I mean, the first bunch of albums were grinding rock records. Then we get to the mid 90s, and you could see that the band was changing. The songs weren't as heavy. They were more lyrically dense, I think. And the Hip got away from, you know, the fully completely sound, from the up to here sound, from the Trouble at the Hen House sound. I remember hearing Nautical Disaster for the first time, which is one of my favorite Hip songs. But that was like a single from that record, which was not, honestly, when it came into the radio station, what we were expecting. We were expecting something, you know, similar to what we had heard for the first, you know, bunch of albums. When they appeared on Saturday Night Live, they played, you know, two songs from that album, which, you know, for their American debut, probably wasn't the smartest move. You know, they should have, you know, come out blazing with maybe a New Orleans Is Sinking or a Courage or something along those lines. But instead, they came out as this cerebral band from Canada. That was on the show because Dan Aykroyd was the guest host, and he was such a huge fan. As the band went on, the songs didn't rock as hard as they did. And the Gord Downie records, you know, starting, you know, Coke Machine Glow did not rock. And the others following it also did not rock in the sense of the Hip's greatest hits, which is the first 4 or 5 records. So, this is not a knock on anybody. This is an example of an artist growing. This is an artist following his muse. This is an artist doing what he must do because it's what his heart says he needs to do as a musician, as a lyricist, as a poet, as a performer. This is where he is at, and this is what's going to come out. Again, you know, when you're a songwriter, you don't have a whole lot of choice when it comes to being creative. It's either there or it's not. And when it's there, you grab what you can. You grab what is tickling your fancy. And that will resonate with some fans, and it won't resonate with other fans. I'll go back to John Frusciante. I mean, when he's with the Red Hot Chili Peppers, the man's a beast on the guitar. And then, you know, how many hit singles have they had? But you go to John Frusciante's solo records, and they're just whacked out, weird guitar records that only like a John Frusciante superfan can really enjoy. Again, not a knock. It just gives you an idea of the two sides, the dualities, the complexity of what it takes to be a creative person over a very long period of time. Remember, you know, Gordon, the band were together in 1985 when they were just coming out of university. And then, you know, they become men in their 20s, men in their 30s, men in their 40s, men in their 50s. And you can't be the same all the way through your life. You should not be the same. You're going to grow and evolve and change. And you're going to find different interests, and things are going to affect you differently emotionally. And it's going to come out. And this is what happened with Gord. And again, he was looking to create music in a certain vein with a certain feel that came from a specific headspace that he was in. And this is what we got. And it's up to us to evaluate it and see if it's right for us. For a lot of people, it is. For like the, you know, the 38 years old, you know, people stuck in that era, it's not going to work. And that's fine. That's the nature of art.
Well, I think that sums it up rather nicely. So we'll use this as a opportunity to thank you very much for joining us this afternoon and answering all our questions and just having a, you know, a conversation about this enigmatic, entertaining and wildly acrobatic vocalist.
He certainly was. I wrote the liner notes for a Fully Completely release a number of years ago. So I got to play in the Tragically Hip's archives.
Oh, wow.
Those archives are really deep. I mean, they saved everything. And I keep close tabs on them. I talk to their manager and I talk to, you know, members of the band every once in a while. There's quite a bit of stuff that has yet to be unveiled. And we're just talking hip stuff. There's got to be Gord stuff sitting there somewhere. Yeah. And over the next decade or so, we're going to be seeing more and more of it. I know it.
Yeah. Didn't they lose some in the fires?
That was the Universal fire in LA. There were, believe it or not, they had copies. I don't think they lost.
Oh, okay.
I think they just lost copies. Okay. I don't think they lost the actual masters. For example, with this Up to Here box set that's coming out, tons of alternate takes, tons of demos, some songs that were recorded for the album but were left off for whatever reason. When Gord was talking to me, Gord Sinclair was talking to me, he says that, you know, this is the way we did. We would come in with you know, way more songs than we needed. And the way it worked back in those days, you would pare it down to 12 songs and you would play the hell out of those 12 songs and then move on to the next record and write songs based on the headspace you were in when you were in the studio or getting ready for that record, leaving all these orphan songs from the previous album in a vault somewhere. And the Hip wrote a lot of songs that are still in a vault somewhere. And they're going to be coming out.
So exciting.
Yeah.
Well, we just got sent to Philadelphia, right? And that took 35 years.
And there's more Saskadelphia type stuff out there. There is. And we'll see it in November with some really early stuff and the demos. And I think it'll be a really interesting counterpoint to anybody who's into the Gord Downie solo albums to go back to an era when the band was much more of a collaborative thing when it came to everything from lyrics and riffs and whatever else. It'll give you an idea of how far the band and Gord evolved from 88, 89 to, you know, sometime in the 2000s.
Oh, it's fascinating. It's you listen to Man Machine Poem, the final record from 2016.
Which is my favorite, by the way, of his.
That's your favorite?
Yep.
Oh, wow. So great, it's like you listen to that record and it's not the same band that released Up to Here, you know,
nope.
25 years earlier. You're like, nope. How do you draw a line to those two things?
I'm going to say that the Man Machine Glow was my favorite latter day Tragically Hip album.
Okay.
My all-time favorite album is Fully Completely. I mean, how do you beat that one?
It's a pretty perfect record.
Yep.
Yeah. Say thank you on behalf of Justin and Craig as well for all that you do and for joining us today. If, you know, we can do anything for you ever, let us know. We are, of course, in the midst of a fundraiser right now that we're raising money for the Gord Downie Fund for brain cancer research. And we're doing that with a big party on July 19th at the Rec Room in Toronto. Tickets are $30 and they're on sale now at discoveringdowney.com. So definitely check that out. And Alan, I'm sure your followers, you know, would be interested in knowing about that as well.
Sure. Excellent.
I don't know what the Venn diagram on hip fans and Island Cross fans are, but I'm sure it's very
some crossover there. There's definitely crossover.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks again. We'll talk.
You're welcome. Soon. Good luck with the podcast.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll see you later.
Bye.
Pick up your shit.
Thanks for listening to Discovering Downey. To find out more about the show and its host, visit discoveringdowney.com. You can email us at discoveringdowney@gmail.com. And hey, we're social. Check us out at Gord Downey Pod.
Duvra! Podcasts and such.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. Everybody needs some variety in life. That's what I love about Chumba Casino. They know how to keep things fresh and exciting. All their games are free to play, like spin slots, bingo, and solitaire. You can claim free daily login bonuses too. And they release new games every week. So spice things up with ChumbaCasino.com now for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply.